for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Amy Bloom is the best-selling author of several novels. Now, after 7 years, she has a brand new book titled Lucky Us, Two Teenage Half-Sisters Journey Through America in the 1940s. Disappointed by their families, they head from small-town Ohio to Hollywood. Author Amy Bloom joins me in the studio, and you are welcome to be part of the program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook, and you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag DRReads. Amy Bloom, it's good to meet you.
It's good to meet you, too.
Thank you. I must say, I'm fascinated as to where the idea for this novel came from. I gather it has to do with a biography of Ava Le Gallienne.
Well, it does, and it's sort of in the essential seed of it, but the biography was terrific, and she was an extraordinary character and a great director and a powerful influence in American theater. And I'm sure if you're not a theater buff, no one remembers her or has heard of her or thought about her.
I do.
I do, too.
Yeah.
But in the middle of her career, there were two striking things about her besides her talent. One was that she was very comfortable and out as a lesbian, which was unusual at the time, and also that she had been in a terrible fire and had hurt and maimed her hand and her neck and part of her face, mm-hmm. and had taught herself a whole lot about contouring and makeup and staging and lighting so that she could go on with her career. And the fire was really the first seed for the novel. And then I began to think about a pair of sisters. And the first piece of the novel that I wrote was actually Gus, the male protagonist of the novel.
Interesting, because he doesn't come in until a little later. So interesting that you should almost begin in the middle and then work your way back.
I often begin in the middle and work my way back. I do.
Huh. Would you read for us from the beginning of the novel? It's so striking, and I think people we'll enjoy hearing it.
Thank you. The beginning is called I'd Know You Anywhere. My father's wife died. My mother said we should drive down to his place and see what might be in it for us. She tapped my nose with her grapefruit spoon. It's like this, she said. Your father loves us more, but he's got another family, a wife, and a girl a little older than you. Her family had all the money. Wipe your face, she said. There was no one like my mother for straight talk. She washed my neck and ears until they shone. We helped each other dress, her lilac dress with the underarm zipper, my pink one with the tricky buttons. My mother did my braids so tight my eyes pulled up. She took her violet hat and her best gloves, and she ran across the road to borrow Mr. Portman's car. I was glad to be going, and I thought I could get to be glad about having a sister. I wasn't sorry my father's other wife was dead. We'd waited for him for weeks. My mother sat by the window in the morning and smoked through supper every night. When she came home from work at Hobson's, she was in a bad mood, even after I rubbed her feet. I hung around the house all July, playing with Mr. Portman's poodle, waiting for my father to drive up. When he came, he usually came by 2 o'clock in case there was a fireside chat that day. We listened to all the fireside chats together. We loved President Roosevelt. On Sundays when my father came, he brought a pack of Lucky Strikes for my mother and a Hershey bar for me. After supper, my mother sat in his lap, and I sat right on his slippers, and if there was a fireside chat, my father did his FDR imitation. Good evening, friends, he said, and he stuck a straw in his mouth like a cigarette holder. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And he bowed to my mother and said, Eleanor, my dear, how about a waltz? They danced to the radio for a while, and then it was my bedtime. My mother put a few bobby pins in my hair for curls, and my father carried me to bed, singing, I wish I could shimmy like my sister Kate. Then he tucked me in and shimmied out the door. Monday mornings he was gone, and I waited until Thursday, and sometimes until the next Sunday. My mother parked the car and redid her lipstick. My father's house was 2 stories of red stone and tall windows, with fringed lace curtains behind, and wide brown steps stacked like boxes in front of the shining wood door. Your father does like to have things nice while he's away, she said. It sure is nice, I said. We ought to live here. My mother smiled at me and ran her tongue over her teeth. Could be, she said. You never know. She'd already told me she was tired of Abingdon, where we'd been since I was born. It was no kind of real town, and she was fed up to hear hostessing at Hobson's. We talked a lot about finding ourselves a better life in Chicago. Chicago, Chicago, that toddlin' town. I sang as we got out of the car, and I did a few dance steps like in the movies. And my mother said, "You are the bee's knees, kiddo," and she grabbed the back of my dress, licked her palm, and pressed it to my bangs so they wouldn't fly up. She straightened her skirt and told me to check her seams. "Straight as arrows," I said, and we went up the stairs hand in hand. My mother knocked, and my father answered the door in the blue vest he wore at our house during the president's speeches. My father hugged me, and my parents whispered to each other while I stood there, trying to see more of the parlor, which was as big as our whole apartment and filled with flowers. "Maybe," my father said. "What the hell are you doing here?" Maybe my mother cursed him for staying away, but I doubt it. My father had played the gentleman his whole life, and my mother must have said to me 100 times that men needed to be handled right, and a woman who couldn't handle her man had only herself to blame. "When I say men are dogs," my mother said, "I'm not being insulting. I like dogs." Behind my mother, I saw a tall girl. "My daughter Iris," my father said, and I could hear my mother breathe in. "Iris," he said, "this is my friend Mrs. Logan and her daughter, her lovely daughter, Eva." I knew, standing in their foyer, that this girl had a ton of things I didn't have. Flowers in crystal vases the size of buckets, pretty light brown curls, my father's hand on her shoulder. She wore a baby blue sweater and a white blouse with a bluebird pin on the collar. I think she wore stockings. Iris was 16, and she looked like a grown woman to me. She looked like a movie star. My father pushed us to the stairs and told Iris to entertain me in her room while he and my mother had a chat.
Whoa, and what a chat that turns out to be. Amy Bloom reading from her brand new novel. It's called Lucky Us. So, the mother simply deposits.
She does. I know that we have a great regard for motherhood as an institution and a sort of general gloss on all women who have babies. But it is not my experience in the wide world that everybody who has a child wants one and that everybody who becomes a mother is good at it. And I wanted to write about somebody who was not.
And who had presumably a child by this gentleman who was a, quote, kept woman who took care of this young daughter until she could no longer do so.
Yes, I think she would say until she could no longer do so. My own perspective, which is a little less kind as the creator of Hazel Logan, is that she chose not to do so.
She was ready to move on, do other things, and to give him the responsibility she felt he so justly deserved.
Absolutely. He was not coming through for her, and she was ready to move forward.
Now, the wonderful part is that these two sisters take a liking to each other. They're quite happy.
They are. After a little while, there's some friction at first. You know, Eva says, "Iris looked at me the way a cat looks at a dog." But eventually they become the way some cats and dogs do, which is very close.
Now, fascinating to me that you spent your early career as a psychotherapist. And I'm sure you saw many, troubled families. And here you focus on two sisters. Tell me why.
I think the focus on the sisters really doesn't come from my clinical background of a long time ago. I think this focus on my sisters comes from the fact that I have a sister. And she's my big sister. And an excellent big sister. And she's almost 6 years older than I am. And we hardly knew each other when I was a little kid. I mean, we really spent very little time together.
How come?
I couldn't really tell you how come. And neither of us really know. But You know, she was.
You lived together.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
We lived together. Right. But she was off doing big girl activities, and I was doing baby activities, and then she was in junior high. And our paths just didn't cross that much. And somehow, when I was about 12 and she was about 18, we found each other.
Oh, how lovely.
And, you know, have not really been apart very much ever since. So I think that that was really the push for me. And also, I am always interested in the relatives and the relationships that work out and the ones that don't, and what we do in the face of the ones that don't work out. And it seems to me that people who are lucky and smart have the opportunity to make another family.
And, of course, you must have brought your understanding of humanity gleaned from your psychotherapy into not just this novel, but writing in general.
Well, I certainly hope so. But the truth is, having taught psychotherapy as well and having supervised a lot of therapists, to a large extent, good therapists are born. They're not made.
Really?
Yeah, you have to be interested in other people.
Absolutely.
And you have to find them interesting in a way that flora and fauna might not be interesting to you. And so the great thing that training as a psychotherapist gave me, it seems to me, was the emphasis on observation and on learning not to finish people's sentences.
Learning to listen. Amy Bloom, her new novel is titled Lucky Us. Short break, and when we come back, we'll talk further about her characters. Take your calls, email. I look forward to hearing from you. And welcome back. If you've just joined me, Amy Bloom is here in the studio. She is, of course, the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Away. Now, after 7 years, she has a brand new book. It's titled Lucky Us, and follows the adventures of two young sisters, actually stepsisters, but nevertheless sisters, who make their way from small town Ohio to Hollywood, where Iris becomes something of a movie star, Amy. That was quite a leap.
Well, it was a leap, although I have to say it's a leap for which there's lots of historical precedent. Because she doesn't become a star. She gets a contract
right. To
become a player, which means that she will be in crowd scenes, in a group of five, the five girls walking down the sidewalk, the three girls at the soda fountain, the two girls waitressing at the restaurant. And she just moves up a little bit until she has a line and then two lines and then an exchange with the second lead. And that is her meteoric rise. And that is as far as she gets.
Because?
Because sometimes bad things happen. And one of the things that happens to her that is good is that she falls in love, and what is bad is that she falls in love with somebody who is deeply untrustworthy and ambitious, and who is actually a character who appears in a way and resurfaces in Lucky Us. We meet her in a way as Razel, the manipulative cousin. We meet her again in Hollywood, having changed her name to Rose Sawyer, America's sweetheart Rose. And Rose basically tosses poor Iris under the bus in order to advance her own career.
Wow.
And Iris is blackballed forever and doesn't quite understand at first, because she's only 19 years old, that there will be no second chance. There will be no opportunity to explain or revise. It's just over.
How old is Ava and how old is Iris when they start out?
They are about 5 years apart, and so they are 12 and 17 when they meet.
And I was thinking back to you and your sister at 12 and 19, sort of finally discovering each other, and thinking about that gap. My own sister was 5 years older than I, and there was a huge gap between us, one that was not resolved. But in your case, even those insurmountable teenage years were surmounted.
Well, they were, and I have to give the credit to my sister, who basically went off to college and said, "I am not leaving you behind." And so I became sort of her mascot and her sidekick, even as she went off to college, and I would get to go visit her on weekends and sleep on the floor of her dorm room, which I think was a little unusual, but very entertaining for both of us. And we discovered each other. And I feel that that was such a gift in my life. And it's not that it's a relationship without its ups and downs. And I also wanted to write about that. I wanted to write about sort of the waxing and the waning and what is involved in being close to another human being, whether they are a sibling or a parent or a spouse or a child, that it is never, you know, a bolt of silk that unfurls in front of you.
Yeah. How did your sister help you to grow?
I'm a great fan of my sister's. I think that she is a remarkably straightforward person. People often say to me, "Oh, Amy, you know, you're so straightforward and you're forthright." And I say, "Oh, you wait till you meet my sister, because, you know, I'm the cream puff." And I love and admire her clarity. She's a terrific lawyer. And when I was in college, I went to watch her practice law, because she was the first woman public defender in Connecticut. And I was just awestruck and then horrified when I realized that the person she was defending was probably guilty. And I thought, oh, this is not the career for me. But nevertheless, you know, her ability to think and to organize and to move forward, and her, you know, her general undauntedness has been wonderful for me to see and wonderful for me to follow.
How do you think you have helped her to grow?
I'm inclined to think that that's probably for her to say, but I think that she values sort of my insights about people, and I think beyond all of that, our basic position with each other is that we are on each other's side, always.
I have friends I consider in that same regard.
Yes, it's a great thing to have in life.
To learn from and to be whatever I am to them.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, I mean, it's just such a great and important gift to have that kind of friendship. These two girls work sometimes together and sometimes not together. Mm-hmm. Tell us about how they move on.
Well, I think the beginning of their relationship, Iris is the big sister and Eva is the sidekick, absolutely. But Iris is also deeply ambitious and a deeply passionate person and doesn't always make the best decisions. And when some of those decisions change the course of their life together, you know, it's like a river forking. Iris goes one way, Eva goes another. And that's painful for both of them, but also probably inevitable because Eva is in the process also of becoming, and the person that she's becoming is not her sister.
How do they simply walk away from their father's house?
I don't think they walk. I think they run. and I think that they are fueled by Iris's rage. This is a girl who has worked very hard to make $5 here and $3 here and $2 there, hitchhiking to elocution contests and, you know, trouncing other girls in some rhetoric contest 45 miles away, which is no small distance in 1940. And she is just furious that her father has stolen her earnings more than once. And this is, as she says to her sister, this is my Hollywood and Vine money. And when Edgar steals the money for the third time and Eva catches him, Iris says, that's it, we're going.
Why is he stealing money from his daughter?
Well, he's stealing money because he needs it.
Why? Doesn't he have a job?
Well, he does have a job, but it's not a very good job. And he got the job by marrying the college president's daughter. And the college president is now retired, and the daughter is dead, and his salary is small. And he is a man who likes, as Hazel said, nice things.
Nice things. And Iris, her ambition takes her, as you said, to Hollywood, leading Eva all the way. How did they get there?
They get there by bus, because that's the only way they could possibly get anywhere. And it takes 60 hours to go from where they are in Ohio to Hollywood. And really, although it is Iris that fuels the departure, it is Eva who insists on being taken along. Eva says to her, I'm going to make you look good. People are going to feel sorry for us. Old people are going to buy us meals. Guys are going to leave you alone because they don't want to be bothered by your pesky little sister. Take me too. And really, Iris gives in. It wasn't her intention at all. She had planned to go by herself. But Eva will not be left behind. And off they go to Hollywood.
What about school?
Well, as you may notice in the novel, at one point Eva says, you know, she was entering 11th grade. She was 13 years old. She had skipped a couple of grades.
She's very bright.
She's very smart and very small and therefore often underestimated. And what she says is that she and Iris both felt that Eva needed more education like a cat needed more fur. And she actually never goes back to school until much later in the novel when she finds her calling.
So they meet Gus in New York. Tell us about Gus.
I love Gus. I have to say,
why?
I love Gus.
Why?
Well, again, it has to do with what Eva says about him, which is that he is the kind of man who would rescue you from a burning building and go back in to get your pet. And he just strikes me as having a lot of the qualities that I really like in people and that I especially like in men and that you find in certain kinds of men. He is just warm and smart and tough and honest, you know, and not above a certain amount of trickery and chicanery on his own part, but that's mostly in the interest of survival. And he's also a great observer in the novel of the bigger world, which Iris and Eva tend not to be so aware of. But Gus, as someone who is German-American during World War II, gets to see an entire different piece of America and bring that forward to us in the novel.
But talk about somebody who gets thrown under a bus. And we're not going to give away that portion, but here you're describing this man who really is genuinely sympathetic, kind, understanding, who does everything he can to demonstrate that kindness, and yet he gets thrown under the bus.
Yes, well, you know, I think it's, you know, Shakespeare said, you know, a comedy is one in which all of the good people are rewarded and it ends happily. And I would say this is not a comedy. It's both. And yes, he is a good person, but he is definitely the wrong person in the wrong place. And in that case, it happens to be a German-American in America at the beginning of World War II, which was a very difficult place to be.
And throughout the novel, we are reminded of that very fact, that the country is at war. There is rationing. There is all kinds of reminders that the country went through some pretty bad times. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones if you'd like to join us. Questions, comments, 800-433-8850. First to Paula here in Washington, D.C. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Hi. What a wonderful program as always. And
good.
What a treat to hear you. You are so lovely and talented with what you do with your questions. Oh. And your guest is wonderful.
Isn't she, though?
Oh, it was such a treat to hear that reading. And in the words of Gwendolyn Brooks, I had the opportunity to meet and work with her many years ago, and she wrote me this lovely note that said, "I salute your talent. I can't find my talent. I want to write, and I'm a frustrated writer. I can write academically, but I can't do what your guest is doing." It feels so lovely to hear you talk about the development of the characters and the scenes. And so when we look at this idea of creativity and imagination and your use of rhetoric, I'm a speech teacher, and you're talking about all these things that are so exciting and wonderful. I want to know, how did you allow yourself to reach that point that you could write and release this and share it, your wonderful talent, because you really are talented. You've drawn me into your story, and I can't wait to get the book.
Good.
Oh, good. That's very kind of you. I think that when you obviously have this great interest and these stories that you want to tell, and there are characters that you want to express, and sometimes the thing you have to do is not hold yourself to too high a standard as you get going. It is much more important to write than to write well at the beginning. You have stories you want to tell and they are not academic, then you should go ahead and put them on paper. If you can't bring yourself to put them on paper, talk into a tape recorder, so that you begin to get the material out, and then you can work on shaping it so that it can be read by somebody else. But part of it is that a lot of people have sort of an internal editor, and it stops you before you even get going. And I would say, try to kill the editor and get the words out.
Just try to get those words out and begin. I think that business about that self-editing process is so important, because there is that voice that says, that's no good. Did you ever have that as you began writing, transitioning from psychotherapy to writing?
I have that voice in my head all the time, every time I start. I usually sit down at my desk, which is a kitchen table, and stare at the screen or stare at the pad. And what I think to myself is, doomed, doomed, doomed. So the voice doesn't go away, but you learn how to push it aside and not think about who's going to read it or what people are going to say. My job always is to serve the story and serve the characters, and everything else is secondary.
Some writers I've talked to have said that as time goes on, the characters begin speaking to you, and then the flow becomes so much easier. Is that what happens to you?
Yes, I wouldn't say that they speak to me. I remember Alice Walker was famous for saying that, you know, she would lie down at night, the characters would come sit at the foot of her bed and talk, and that has never happened to me. But
don't you wish?
Don't you wish? Absolutely. Anytime, I'd be happy to listen. They don't talk to me, but they talk, and I can hear their voices. And once I can hear their voices, I can begin to see them and feel them and allow them opportunities to come to life, which is really what you hope. It's like blowing on embers. But once you catch a little bit, it is easier. But before you have sort of caught fire, it is just a painful slog.
And the only way to write is to write.
Alas, yes, it is.
No other way to do it.
No, Amy, I keep looking.
And her new novel is titled Lucky Us. When we come back, more of your calls, your comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times foreign correspondent Rukmini Kalamaki about her investigation into Al-Qaeda's lucrative business of kidnapping for ransom. And we'll talk about the trove of Al-Qaeda documents she discovered in North Mali, documents left behind by the jihadists when they fled, and what they reveal about Al-Qaeda's operations. Join us.
And welcome back. Amy Bloom is with me. We're talking about her brand new novel. It's titled Lucky Us, and really recounts the story of two stepsisters who move across the country, one with her eye on Hollywood, the other the keeper, and their adventures as they go. Part of the book contains letters, and Amy Bloom, if you would read the letter from Iris to Eva that was unsent.
Yes, I have a great interest in letters that are not sent, letters that are not read. This is from Iris after the war, referring to a time earlier at the beginning of the war. Dear Eva, you think it'd be hard to get a man plucked out of his everyday life on Long Island and shipped off somewhere. You think it'd be at least awkward. You had read that whole article about Ezio Pinza aloud at breakfast, famous opera singer, basso cantante, and before this, famous only for his voice and for his first wife having sued a soprano at the Metropolitan Opera House for alienation of affection. According to you and Time magazine, he married another American girl, not the alienator of affection, and they had a daughter. And the article said that he was released after 2 months at Ellis Island and that he went back to singing opera right away. That's what stuck with me. He didn't spend a day in jail. He wasn't even arrested. He just went away for 2 months. Do you know, at the end of the war, Ezio Pinza sang the Star Spangled Banner for General Patton and General Doolittle and for the man who had ordered his arrest? This also courtesy of Time magazine. I was so scared, I thought I'd vomit on the bus. I walked past the railroad station to put enough distance between it and me. I always ran into people I knew at that end of town. I had a handful of dimes in my bag. I put a handkerchief over the receiver. A man answered, and I thought they must all sound like J. Edgar Hoover with his high, flat voice. I couldn't remember the agent's name 5 minutes after I hung up. I made up a character for myself for the phone call. I was a single lady from Hartford, Connecticut, visiting friends in Great Neck. I worked in a bank. I told the man that Gus Heitmann might be, maybe, a German spy. I said that I knew that everyone had to do their part in the war effort, and my voice shook like I was on a train. I said I hoped I was doing the right thing. The man did not say, "You lying bitch." He said that I was doing my duty. He repeated Gus's name and the address of his repair shop, and he thanked me twice. I was sweating like a whore in church, not surprisingly, and I wiped my face with my mother's blue lace hanky, and I threw it in the trash can at the train station.
So, whether the letter was sent or not, Iris had turned Gus in.
She had.
Why?
Because she was in love with his wife. I wish I could make it less bald, but that's entirely why, and that is the kind of thing that happened during wartime. It is the type of thing that happens when you have a country in a xenophobic mood.
You just want to get rid of everyone who seems other.
You want to get rid of the others in a big way, and in fact, we interned 11,000 Germans who lived in this country, not prisoners of war, not people who were coming to this country from Germany, although we did actually by mistake, in the way of tragedy and farce, we did actually manage to imprison a number of Jewish refugees from Germany, not quite understanding what the relationship was between the Jews and the German government at the time, but eventually we did release them.
Of course, we've heard so much about the internment of Japanese, but not as much about the internment of Germans.
No, not as much about the internment, and also not about the offer that was made to Germans in those internment camps to self-deport, which was the phrase of the time in which they were offered an opportunity to go back to Germany, I will say, just in time to be bombed by the Allies.
You did a great deal of research on those internment camps. Tell me about that.
You know, I didn't know anything. I mean, I'm embarrassed by my own ignorance. I didn't know anything about the internment of Germans in this country during World War II. And I was just beginning to research that period and came across a first-person account by somebody who had been an 11-year-old boy. His parents had been in New Jersey. They had lived there for 30 years. And he had, I think they had gone back and forth from Germany, so he hadn't been born in this country, but he had been in this country since he was a year old, and describes his life in the camps, and that I just was fascinated. And so I began to research more about it, and it was very interesting. Also, Truman was very concerned that Germans would blend in so easily with, as they would have said then, regular Americans, that they had decided that they would keep the Germans in the camps until at least 2 years after the war ended. So I believe the last German was released from the camp in 1947.
Wow. All right, let's go back to the phones to Leanne in Guilford, Connecticut. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane Rehm and Amy Bloom. I'm so much enjoying this conversation you're having.
Glad to have you with us.
When I heard Amy say that people don't often remember Eva LeGallien, I want to say I do. I grew up in Westport in the 40s, and I was in a theater group run by Claire Olson when I was an early teenager. And one summer, we put on Midsummer Night's Dream at Eva LeGallien's outdoor theater in the evening. And I believe that was behind her house in New Canaan, if my memory serves correctly. Do you know about that, Amy? Did
absolutely. That absolutely. I'm sure your memory is entirely correct about that.
Uh-huh. All right. And then you went on to mention Ezio Pinza.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with my mother on a train station in London when I was 10 years old. And suddenly she cries out, "Look, there's Ezio Pinza," and handed me my diary, and I've got his autograph. Huh. I had no idea, of course, who he was, but those were the days when we carried autograph books and those things with us traveling. And so that was an interesting connection, too. And then one more thing. My first brother, younger than I, was born just at the outbreak of the war. And my father, who has a Swiss-German name, would not pass on his name to that first brother. The second brother was born just after the war, and he would pass on his family name to that brother.
Hmm. Interesting. Which
has been a sore point, I think. Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I didn't catch that last part.
I think that probably did happen often.
Oh, absolutely. I think those were very difficult decisions that parents made about protecting their children and protecting themselves.
From?
From the idea that they were the other and they were the enemy.
Amy, this cover has got to be the most unusual I think I've ever seen. Let me see if I can describe it for our listeners. It would seem that it is either on a stage or looking out a window, curtains hanging, draperies hanging on either side in red, a deep pink peony at the bottom and at the top, and on a tightrope walking across, must be 20 feet high, is a lion, a male lion, a beautiful lion. No, I think it's a female lion. I'd take that back. And on top of that lion is a zebra balanced perfectly. Looks like another female. And on top of that zebra is a barely noticeable bird. Tell me about this cover.
I can only talk about the cover, really, in terms of the artist, who's a woman named Deborah Van Auten, who's an enormously talented painter. And this painting is called Earthrise, because what you see to the right of the zebra is the earth, where one would normally see the moon. What struck me about this was, when I looked at the painting, what I thought to myself is, lucky that the lion doesn't fall off the tightrope. Lucky that the zebra doesn't get eaten by the lion. Lucky that the bird gets to ride. And that, I sent it to my editor and said, what do you think? It just seems right. And there was a sort of lot of back and forth, but the general feeling was, yes, if we can make this work, we would like to make this work.
Wow. Well, but in some ways, these two girls are lucky, but in other ways not so lucky.
Absolutely. Luck is not just good luck. You know, it's like the blues songs. You know, sometimes if it wasn't for bad luck, you wouldn't have any luck at all. And that is certainly true for these characters sometimes.
Well, and each of the chapters has a song title.
It does. I love the music of that period of the 30s and 40s. It's just, it's an enormously exciting period, and the growth of jazz and so many terrific singers, and every single song title isn't, every single chapter is a song title, some of them more obscure than others, but it was a great part of the writing and the researching to listen and just sink into this music and be lifted up by it.
How wonderful. All right, let's go back to the phones to Scott in Tacoma Park, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hello, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was listening to the program, I must admit, initially kind of just was kind of in the background, but I heard the thing about the German internments. I was aware of that, but I grew up in a small town in central Pennsylvania where the hierarchy of the town was dominated by long-term Germans. I mean, my family came to the United States in the 1600s. My last name is Schadel. My mother's name was Dietrich. On the block that I lived on in this small town during periods of World War II, three escaped German POWs lived there through the end of the war. The soldiers heard workmen at the camp speaking Pennsylvania Deutsch. Some of them spoke better German because there were a lot of local German-speaking Lutheran churches. They escaped. And if they were just some farm boy from Germany or some child who was just, you know, drafted into the German army, and the Americans knew about it. And as long as these weren't real Nazis or SS or anything like that, they were perfectly kind of fine. They watched these people. They had people watching them. But they just worked as day laborers and lived in the homes of people and helped them.
That's an amazing story and a really interesting contrast to what happened to some people who were longtime residents of the United States and also of German background. So that's a fascinating story.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's see, Patricia in Silver Spring, Maryland has a question. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, was it hard to keep out modern 21st century jargon out of the 1940s scenes? I noticed that you said, in quoting the letter, a reference to, I'll be a single lady. Well, that is a 1940s reference, essentially. Today we would have said, you know, a single girl. So was it hard to keep out the modern jargon?
It really wasn't hard. I think there's something about if you do enough research and you pay enough attention, and I did also watch a lot of movies of the 30s and 40s, it becomes alive. And so it was no different for me than living in the world now. It's just you sort of enter it. And my goal was to make it not seem like a historical piece, but to make it feel as if it was happening right now. It's just that we were visiting the country of the past.
And you actually bring in the little blue books. Talk about those little blue books.
Oh, I love the little blue books. My dad was a great fan. My dad was a journalist, and he was a great fan of the interesting fact and the obscure notion and, in general, an admirer of autodidacts of all sorts, which certainly included both of my grandfathers, who both left school when they were about 10. And little blue books were designed in the early part of the 20th century for working people. And at that time, that would have meant working men. They were the size of your back pocket. And they were a nickel and then a dime. And it was everything you could ever want to know in the world. So the titles ranged from the short stories of Balzac to Proverbs of Japan to What Every Married Woman Should Know, written, by the way, by Margaret Sanger. To the history of the East, written by Will Durant, to the stories of O. Henry, to how to make candy, and the underlying principles of Christianity.
Huh.
And you could subscribe. And I believe when it finally began to wrap up, which was in the 40s, I think they had published 5,000 titles.
Oh. My goodness. Did you collect any of them?
I did collect a few. I couldn't resist. You know, you find them in archives and occasionally on eBay, sort of under the heading of ephemera, right? Of those paper things that will not last.
What was the paper?
It was just a nasty, cheap, sort of slightly heavy blue paper on the outside and quite thin paper on the inside. But it's so easy to see somebody sitting on a break, eating a sandwich, reading the short stories of Balzac.
Amy Bloom, her new novel, Lucky Us. I feel as though I have been the lucky one this morning. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, and it was just a pleasure to talk about the book in this way.
Loved it. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Natalie Urlifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive.